Episode 6, The Metal Guys Talk Business. This week we was joined with Rebecca Galley, who's the Managing Director of Hydroscans UK. Done this podcast in the Jeweller's Arms, which was nice. It was a change not to have to be driven by you, Peter.
Yeah, but you like that though, don't you? You like sitting there playing with the Spotify and, you know, Backstreet Boys.
Also like that app, Wazy, whatever it's called.
Waze,
yeah. There's a copper, there's a speed camera.
Yeah.
It makes me very observant.
You liked it every time a car was pulled over that you could put it and help the other Wazers.
Yeah. That's what it's a free plus app.
It's a good bit of kit, that is.
It's a good bit of kit. This week, the podcast, normally we just say, roll the music. But this time you've done some sound bites.
Yeah. I got some constructive feedback from a listener. And he said, on the better quality podcasts that are out there, they normally give a couple of sound bites of what's going to appear in the show. Like, you know, with the TV program that you might have, you know, back in the old days when you couldn't just watch everything on demand.
Yeah.
And you had to wait a week and you had to watch commercials and stuff. So he said, what you need to
do.
Like the Bill, police camera action.
I met him once, you know, Reg.
From
the Bill, yeah. Yeah, he was in the Trafford Centre in Manchester.
Oh, yeah.
Reg, yeah.
Did you get a picture?
No. I mean, he's not famous, is he? But I just recognised him.
Well, it's famous enough for you to mention him now.
There's a lot of people who like Reg, aren't there?
Well, I don't know. I never watched the Bill.
He's just an ordinary bloke, isn't he, Reg? Nice bloke, receptionist.
Yeah. Everyone's been on the Bill, though. Any bit part actor has been on the Bill. And Casualty.
Danny Dyer.
And Doctors. Danny Dyer. I bet Danny Dyer has.
I bet he ain't.
I bet he has.
Yeah, he ain't.
I want to Google it. I bet he ain't. I like the way you're so confident about it.
I'll tell you why I'm confident. That stopped in about 96. Danny Dyer is only about 36, so there's no chance of it. Maybe it's a bit later than 96. Yeah, maybe. But I mean, it was good, the Bill. Tuesday, Thursdays.
I used to get it mixed up with Heartbeat.
Oh, no, I didn't like Heartbeat. George liked Heartbeat. But that's
I don't understand that, because George liked it. Surely that didn't start, he wasn't born then.
No, that's what I mean. He watches it now. Do you know what I mean? He's the only bloke who does a series link on a programme that stops producing.
But yeah, going back to the reason I got the sound bites.
Yeah.
On those type of programmes, back in the day, when you might have forgot what happened the following week, they would show you a few little teasers of what had happened the previous week. And then the Americans started doing this, where they'd tease you into what you were going to see in the programme. So the sound bites are a teaser for the listener to be like, this sounds interesting.
I remember being told that the team in Latvia had moved their trade counters outside so they could serve customers in the open air.
Right.
And I was thinking, okay.
I can't do 3 weeks continually at the gym. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but the gym's a whole different kettle.
I brought a bollock. I did 3 weeks on my own, never mind. I should have been signed up for something like this.
Some of the senior decision makers saw me as the person I had been 10 years ago rather than the person I had developed into. So at the time, I had it in my head that if I didn't get an MBA, I wouldn't get on in my career. There are still women who don't help, though. You know, and again, I'm not down on women, absolutely not. Don't want it to sound like I am, but I was once asked if I would speak at a women's group.
Right.
I had to say, well, no, because by separating yourselves, you're perpetuating the problem.
Hey guys, Pete Comerford, Mike Bolton.
The Metal Guys.
We're joined today by Rebecca Galley. She's the Managing Director of Hydroscans in the UK. How's things, Rebecca?
Yeah, good. Thanks for inviting me.
Not a problem. Rebecca started her career 20 years ago now, worked briefly in aerospace and then at SIG, or SIG, people probably have heard of. Worked way up over, were you there? Like 9 years or 10 years that you were there?
Probably longer. I think it was 15 years in total in different parts of the company.
And then you moved over to Cromwell, worked as the National Operations. Were you National Operations Director, were you?
Yes, yeah.
And then the position came up with Hydroscans a year ago. Although we've just been saying it seems like much, much longer given what's been going on for the last year. But if we can just start, could you just talk to us about your early career and how you got into this industry sector?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, my first job was an estimator at an aerospace company. And at the time, I'd left school aged 19. I'd good grades at A-level, but no experience apart from a bit of waitressing as a teenager.
Yeah.
And nobody would give me a job. And I went for the interview at Brookhouse Aerospace, as it was. And I said to the gentleman interviewing me at the time, you know, this is crazy. I can't get a job because I don't have experience, and I'll never get experience if no one gives me a job. And actually, he rang me before I got home on the bus to give me the job. So that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And my first day started with him asking me, you know about spreadsheets, don't you? And me saying yes, despite the fact I'd never seen one before. And we took it from there. And I worked there about 12 months. And then I'd moved out by this stage and I had rent to pay and I needed to earn more.
Yeah.
And that wasn't going to be possible where I was. So I ended up doing telesales for Protec Direct, which was a PPE distribution company. Still is, actually. And at the time, it was owned by SIG, who were a big construction material distribution business.
Because PPE, I'm guessing nowadays, that must be a really ruthless market sector.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people involved in PPE. Some are specialist, you know, and expert and very professional and experienced companies. And then, you know, there's people at the opposite end of that spectrum. But I mean, the what we've just been through, it's been in massive demand.
Yeah.
I think it's quite a complicated market, particularly given a lot of the supply comes from the Far East.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't been involved with it for a good few years now.
Talk to us about the telesales then, because having met you, you don't strike me as someone who have the headset on and just be doing 150 calls a day.
I did put a headset on. I didn't make 150 calls a day, I don't think. We used to focus more on meaningful talk time than just numbers.
Yeah.
But when I first joined, it was me in a room for 12, which we did fill. But when I joined, it was just me in a room with a pile of reports, one page per customer of lapsed accounts. And the instruction was, phone them up. So I did. And we reopened quite a number of accounts. I think just reminding people that we existed was enough, really, at that point. And then we quickly built up the team and, you know, organised ourselves and trained ourselves. And we did quite well.
How did you feel about having to do that? I mean, when you'd never done it before. I mean, I remember the first time I had to start cold calling. You're almost worrying about people listening and just all these kind of concerns. And then worried about, you know, when you get through to actually like a salesperson, I suppose, at that stage. I mean, how did you feel about having to do that?
I guess at the time I didn't really think about it too much. It was here's a pile of customer accounts, phone them up. And I don't know if it was the benefit of youth, but I just got on with it. And the more that I did it, the more it was successful. And then the more I enjoyed it. So, and I was on my own in a very big room, so no one was listening anyway.
Oh, that's right then.
I find that difficult because sometimes it's difficult to self-motivate. Both me and Mike have worked doing telesales as well in times in our career. But I've always worked where it's been a big team. So you've got that buzz of kind of people are doing hitting deals all the time. So that kind of spurs you on. So how did you kind of motivate yourself to just keep bashing through the phone? Because obviously there are the odd call where they're not the most savoury.
No. People tell you where to take yourself, but it's not personal. And I would go and have a cup of tea or go downstairs to where other humans were and have a moan and then get back on it. But we did grow the team quite quickly. And then we did have that healthy competition, you know, and the buzz of actually we're all in this together and lots of deals going on.
So you said right at the outset there, you were with SIG for almost 15 years. Sorry for not bringing my proper notes with me.
No problem.
How was it that you managed to go all the way through the ranks at SIG? Because I think sometimes people listen to this and they feel that they get blocked at certain stages. How was it that you kind of overcame that and managed to go through that company?
I think when I first moved to Sheffield, so I left Protec, it was 2006, and moved to the commercial services management role in Sheffield. That was such a great opportunity.
Mm.
And I built the department, you know, we took on extra functions and I built a big network because I was working with all of the branches across the country. So I built a big network and helped people, and I helped people in head office and I helped people in the branches, and then more people would come to me. So I guess what I'm saying is I built a good reputation for being someone who got things done.
How did that opportunity just, you know, present itself to you, though?
It was clear at the time, and I guess this is a theme throughout the discussion, it was clear at the time when I was ready to leave ProTec that I was ready to leave ProTec.
Yeah.
I'd kind of done everything I could do there, and there weren't the opportunities for me to step up within that company specifically. So I was going to go somewhere, and it was great that the senior team in ProTec, obviously part of SIG, new people in the group, and there was this opportunity in Sheffield. Obviously had to go through the right process, but being part of that group, I think, and that network that was already in place was how I got into Sheffield.
Mm.
And then, you know, there were lots of high profile projects, I think, that I was given responsibility for early that enabled me to prove what I could do, really.
Yeah, so I suppose they didn't really want to lose you, so it was one of these where We need to give you this opportunity.
Yeah, that was how it went.
You know, with obviously spent 15 years with SIG.
Mm.
Do you think that's a big part of it? A lot of people we've done podcasts with who have progressed, they've stayed with the companies for a long period of time. I think people now, say myself, have been like 3-4 years at a company, mm. and you're not quite getting the progression. You've seen a few roles come where they've recruited from outside the business. Sometimes you can get a bit frustrated. Frustrated, do you think it is about, you know, doing a long period of time in one company? Or
it's such a difficult balance. I mean, that certainly was the case at SIG, and I did have that great network, and I'd built the reputation internally. But we've seen it both ways around. You know, when I was working as operations director in Cromwell, I was really keen to promote internal candidates as much as we possibly could, you know, because you don't want people to see, oh, they're always going to bring people in from outside. But sometimes when you're building a team, the specific knowledge or the specific experience isn't available within the team, so you do have to bring people in. So I guess it's double-edged. And when it came to the time for me to leave SIG, unfortunately, because I had been there for so long, some of the senior decision-makers saw me as the person I had been 10 years ago rather than the person I had developed into. So there's lots of different ways of looking at the same thing. But at the time, early on, it definitely helped me.
That's an interesting thing that you say there, that people seen you from the person you was 10 years ago.
Mm.
I worked at a company when I first started. And when I started off as an apprenticeship, I was there for like 5.5 years. But some people in that organisation still see me as the office junior and not the person I'd actually developed in. It's quite an interesting point you make there, because I definitely can relate to that.
How did you overcome that? Because it is a problem.
Well, in the end, I left SIG. I'm not sure I did overcome it. I had eventually, having done lots of different roles within SIG, and perhaps we can come back to that, but eventually when I knew it was time to leave, I started to look elsewhere, and the level of role that I was looking for at the time was much higher.
Hmm.
And I actually had a really honest conversation with someone at SIG, and they said that to me. They said, yeah, you have come a long way, haven't you? And perhaps we haven't, you know, supported you.
But in saying that, you did your MBA there.
I did, and they definitely
and they funded
supported,
that. So there's, you know,
they definitely supported
monetarily.
Me with that. They did. No, it was great.
Why did you do the MBA?
So at the time, I was commercial services manager at SIG, and everyone around me, as in the next roles up, all had MBAs.
Yeah.
So in my mind at the time, in my late 20s, I had no undergraduate degree either, because I went straight from school to,
right,
I want to get a job. So at the time, I had it in my head that if I didn't get an MBA, I wouldn't get on in my career. So I had to have it. I had to go and do it.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate, really fortunate, that the team around me there did support me and they funded the MBA.
Because there's a lot of people who do MBAs. There's certain businesses where I see MBAs all the time and others I don't.
Yeah.
How important do you think it was for you to do that? Because obviously it's a big investment of time, isn't it? Outside, you know, it's
massive.
You wouldn't want to do it again, would you?
Well.
Maybe.
Maybe. It was a massive investment of time. Absolutely it was.
Yeah. But do you think it's been, you know, looking back at it, was that a really, really sensible decision to
yes.
do that?
Yes, it was.
You know that level of commitment, though? Because people don't... I've found, like, just... Because when I listen to people like yourself, I'm in, like, awe of it, really. Because I look at it, in like, when I've worked in these organisations, and really,
when you sat there on the desk or you're doing the BTM, you look at people in the organisation and you don't actually appreciate how they've got there. You almost look at it and think, well, he was mates with Watch Callers, so he's got it that way. You know, like really petty and really actually quite an immature way of looking at it. But actually coming out of that kind of bubble where you're just blinded, you've got the blinkers on, you're like, you've got there because of this reason, or blah, blah, blah. But the more I've spoke to people and listened to yourself, listened to Sue the other week and Rob Bryan, is actually you've had to do so much sacrifice away that you don't see what goes behind where you leave at 5 o'clock and just drive off the car park and, you know, you ring the missus and see what you've got for tea and just switch off. There's actually someone's doing further education, they're doing courses, they're spending time away from home, of going to you know, European offices, or, and really you have no idea.
It's particularly when people are a little bit older. When I notice and I see people have done their MBAs, for instance, or other qualifications that have taken a number of years where they've done them through Open University, sometimes they're married, they've got children, they've got a high-pressure job, they're travelling, and then they're doing that. And it's like, it's not Mickey Mouse. Like, it's tough. I know that you end up doing a lot of your course is relatable to the business that you're in.
Yes.
So you do projects that actually benefit the business. And that's why companies will pay.
Exactly.
Because they think, well, actually, we need to know about this.
Yep.
So let's use it's someone who's actually got...
Really. Yeah, it's... 3 years of fair bridge going, I can't do 3 weeks continual at the gym. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, but the gym's a whole different kettle.
I brought a bike and did 3 weeks on my own. Never mind. I've never been signed up for something like this.
But going back to your MBA, how... Other people that might be listening to this are thinking, you know, I want to get to that next step in my career. I want to be the next MD. I want to become a director in a business. Is there any reason that someone shouldn't do that? Has it been really fundamentally important with your progression because you've got MBA?
I think it has.
Yeah.
I think it adds a lot in terms of credibility, not only to potential employers, but also to my colleagues and especially to myself. Mm. So one of the key things that I took from the MBA was the knowledge that I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, having not got an undergraduate degree and having, you know, not got the experience that people in the MBA cohort had, you know, I was in there with some senior people doing this course. And the fact that I could hold my own in those environments and lead projects with international business people I'd never met before, that gave me so much in terms of self-belief.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, all the experience of the different facets of business that I hadn't necessarily been fully exposed to.
I would say
it was great.
Yeah, did you feel like maybe you had that kind of almost imposter syndrome when you were sitting with these people?
I certainly did. The first module I went to, because I did it in executive MBA, so you would go for a week.
Yeah.
And then you would have to do an assignment within 6 weeks. And I did 13 modules and then a dissertation over 4 years. But the first module I went to was organisational behaviour.
Right.
There's me with 50 people from around the world all in senior jobs, some of whom were into this stuff, you know, talking about postmodernist theories of organisational behaviour. And I spent the first 2 full days thinking, there's been a mistake. I'm not in the right place. Mm-hmm. We got through the first module, and the second module was operations management. I thought, it's going to be all right. going to be okay. I can do this thing. But the more that I did it, you know, the more confident I got, and I guess experience helps with that, doesn't it?
How did you get through that? You know, like the self-doubt at the start of the first module. Because some people would just quit, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Then there's a lot more, there's probably more people who would, when it comes to something they can't do or don't feel they're capable of doing, they quit. So what made you continue and get through that? Because it must have been hard when you feel that people in this room or, you know, doing it are better than you in some ways, or feeling that way. It's quite an emotion.
It's intimidating.
I know this is a horrible cliche to give as an answer, but when you're in that position, that is the time when you're going to learn the most. And being able to recognise that from having been there many times, and I have been there many times where I've got into a position and thought, I can't do this. But knowing that when you get there, this is where you really learn and grow, helps you to carry on. Also, the fact that I'd worked so hard to get myself there, and so many people were behind me and investing in me. I didn't want to let them down, so quitting wasn't really an option from that perspective. So I had to just dig in, and I talked to, you know, people I trust about how I felt about it, and they were saying, you know, stick with it, it's going to be all right. And it was, and it usually is. So I guess I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, 100%, yeah, brilliant.
You kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier. You were at SIG a long time.
Yep.
Was it difficult to move away from that company?
No, because at the time I was ready to go, and there were no opportunities immediately available within the group.
Yeah.
So I left the head office in Sheffield in 2011 to take on a role as a general manager for a company they had previously acquired. At the time, it was losing money, and my remit was to, you know, make
stop
it work.
Stop doing that.
Yeah, make it, you know, generate a return. And at the end of that, at a point where we had done that, we had made it successful, I'd also just finished my MBA, and I was just about to have a child. So I'd taken a year out, having in my mind finished that project, if you like. So at that point, I was already thinking, what do I do next? You know, what do I go back and do? And that's how I sort of came about the project at the off-site manufacturing company, was because I was talking to the people at SIG saying, you know, ready for a new challenge, coming back after 12 months maternity. So I went and did that, but even that wasn't challenging me. So I was ready for the next thing, whatever it was, and looked inside SIG, but it transpired that the right thing was at Cromwell.
You know, you took that challenge where you have to turn a business to making profit or breaking even. So a lot of people who'll be listening to this are running service centres or distribution companies where that is their remit. Normally, when you get the job, you normally get the one that needs a bit of a kickstart again. What's it like having that challenge? Is it because you're probably going into an office environment or warehouse environment as well, both linked together, that they just feel a little bit lost within what's going on. They're trying hard, but nothing's really coming off. You know, there's sometimes when I worked in the industry, your targets were that big that you almost felt that it's going to take years to turn this around unless you suddenly get one big whale account. But very rarely does that happen. You know, what's it like having to try and rally everyone together to try and get to that goal that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, I went into it knowing full well that it was going to take years. It was in my mind, and in the group were supportive of the fact that it was a 3-year project. And I arrived to find a disgruntled, demotivated team and, you know, a shop, a trade counter area that was just a couple of pallets on the floor and some dust. You know, it needed a kickstart, to say the least. But my approach to it was just to talk openly and honestly with everybody and find out what they thought was wrong and what they wanted, you know, and represent the group. Because I came from the group, and a lot of the challenges were to do with the lack of integration after the acquisition. I was able to sort of be a conduit, if you like, between the team that were there and the group, and represent both parties to the other. So it was about being open, honest, telling them straight what needed to happen, but also listening to what they had to say, and knowing that it was a big job.
Because this is basically your module one, isn't it? Organisational behaviour.
Oh, it was everything. I mean, my dissertation is actually about strategies to achieve turnarounds.
Ah, right, okay. So how did you do it then? If you don't mind, I mean, you don't have to give us all the tricks, but...
How did we do it? We cut some costs straight away. You know, you have to cut your cloth to what you've currently got, but also with a view on what we wanted to achieve. So we had underutilised vehicles, for example, so we returned them to the group. We put stock out in the trade counter. Yeah. We made sure the right people were doing the right roles and that they were suitably trained to do them, and that it was clear to everyone what, you know, what they should be doing. And, you know, the key part of it is talk to customers. Try and win back the customers that had been lost. Talk to customers of the wider group. I mean, that was a massive opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, we're a fixings business, and up the road there's a ceilings business, and we're not working with those customers. You know, so that was sort of the stereotypical low-hanging fruit, if you will.
Yeah.
And just create some drive.
Yeah. So the lapsed accounts, you know, the non-spends, it's amazing how many people stop ringing them because they feel awkward to ring them, or we upset them, we got that order wrong. And but most people, are, you know, I've found is that they're always trying to give you a second chance if you just admit that you've done things wrong or things have changed and can tell them that. But sometimes I think those accounts that are actually aware of your business, have had a trading history where you've got an account still open, people don't necessarily concentrate on those. They're always trying to find the new ones who haven't heard of you. But that's hard sometimes to get those business where your lapsed ones, I used to go on concentrating a lot because I used to think, they're already aware of us as a business. We've already got credit terms. I don't need to do all that. It's a quick quick process, isn't it? You know,
provided that the reason that they went away is not too serious, I find the door's always partly open.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think even if it's serious, you know, sometimes you can go and have the conversation with people. I mean, I know it myself. Like, there's been things that have happened with my previous business that they were out of your hands. You didn't do them on purpose, but you've caused someone a complete nightmare, catastrophic for them sometimes. And yeah, you have to leave it a little bit of time. But I think time is a healer. And sometimes when you go and have that conversation, especially because you're having a proper business conversation with them, they realise that it wasn't, I know it's a cliche, it's you know, it's business, it's not personal, is it?
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. And sometimes you can still win those businesses back, because I think when you've got a problem, you have so much dialogue. Bizarrely, you build sometimes better relationships with people and you get to know them better, dealing with the horror show.
It's an interesting
that you've
point.
Created.
It is an interesting point. And one of my first conversations when I went to the fixings business was with a supplier, a key supplier. Mm. And his opening statement to me was, "We're taking away your terms."
Right.
So that was a very intense discussion.
Yeah.
As an opening statement. But actually, we built such a good relationship, and almost getting all that out on the table day one kind of accelerated the building of the good relationship. So, yeah, you've got a good point.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, I didn't pay
you. Did you, we spoke about this with Sue in the podcast last week. Because you're female, it's a very masculine industry sector still. If we jump back to when you came into this business to turn it round, did you have any issues because of your gender?
No, not at all. Not there. I mean, I have in other parts of my career, but not there.
Yeah.
Largely because I was replacing a woman.
Ah, right. Okay.
So they were accustomed to having a female general manager. So not there, no. Yeah. Not at all.
How about, obviously, the next logical question is to talk about maybe some of the issues that you have had and had to overcome.
I mean, I think this is a new dissertation in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's so multifaceted. But, I mean, I've seen lots of things. Some people don't know how to handle having a woman as a boss if they've never had a woman as a boss before. Particularly I experienced that at Cromwell, and Cromwell is actually very forward thinking now. I've got the gender pay results from the last full year I worked there, and they're well ahead of the industry,
right?
But it was a relatively new concept when I first joined the business. And I went on a branch visit, and an anonymous branch manager said to me, "Do you know much about cutting tools, love?" To which I had to say, "No, but that's not what I'm here to do."
Right.
But that was the sort of thing, because people weren't used to working with women, I suppose.
Yeah.
In a very traditional environment. But at SIG, again, it was totally different because there were senior women.
Yeah.
The issue there was a different one, actually. And I'm very pleased to say I don't see this anymore, but that was actually the women weren't supporting each other. Say, I have seen a big change, and certainly at Cromwell, they definitely did.
What would you be saying to people, you know, because obviously this to me sounds like this is an educational thing, people just not getting it really and having kind of outdated, almost like chauvinistic views about people's place, really. How would you, you know, what would you say to employers about how they can help minimise this or completely get rid of it?
I suppose I've got two viewpoints on this. One is that as far as I'm concerned, I am a professional individual going out about my business to the best of my ability, and so are you, and so are you, and so is everybody else. And whether we're, you know, male, female, other, doesn't matter to me. But there are still, unfortunately, less now, but there are still, unfortunately, cases where there is discrimination against women or for other reasons. And in my opinion, employers need to address it really quickly. Mm. And it doesn't matter who the person is, at what level the person is. Anyone who is behaving inappropriately or discriminating, it should just be addressed almost publicly to make the point that it's not acceptable.
For me, it's... I don't want to stereotype, but it's a certain era of where it comes from. From my experience of seeing it in workplaces, is that I think it's like, I think, I don't know, maybe our generation, I don't know. Like, I just think we're more open-minded as where we just, you just see things and you're almost just like, well, that's just the way it is.
Is that right, though? Because you're right. There is that kind of stigma that it's old people. But you've obviously seen it. You know, me and Mike aren't seeing this particular kind of caveat in our business career. But is it just that older generation that's not educated, or have you had it with a range of different people?
So I would say the direct... And I'm only speaking from my own experience, this isn't a proper scientific study, but in my experience, it has been older people.
Yeah.
It has been.
Because to me, it just wouldn't... It would never even come across my mind.
But there are still women who don't help, though. You know, and again, I'm not down on women, absolutely not. Don't want it to sound like I am, but I was once asked if I would speak at a women's group.
Right.
I had to say, well, no, because... By separating yourselves, you're perpetuating the problem.
And
you know, I think that it's because I'm a woman mentality actually is counterproductive.
And
right now, I mean, it's awkward for me to think that positive discrimination is going on because, you know, I want to get the job because I'm the best person for the job.
Absolutely.
But I think there is some of that at the minute as people are trying to address this.
Yeah. I mean, from my own experience, like I've seen, and is that... There's a key part of your career. When you went on maternity leave for 12 months, you come back and you were still craving that challenge.
Yeah.
I'll put it to the example of the person I had two children with. She was looking to go within management. But as soon as we had Caden, actually that drive and what she wanted to do, it went a little bit because actually the main focus for her at the time, for whatever reason, was, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And maybe financially... As a family, we wasn't able to just go, well, we can put our child into full-time nursery and stuff. But I do think that also lays an issue with why sometimes we don't see more females in the talent pool for senior roles.
I'm really pleased you've said that because this is something I did want to talk about, actually. And I think some of the reason, you know, going back to the gender pay gap, some of the reason there is a pay gap is because there aren't as many women in senior roles. And actually that, I think, my own reflections are it's societal. In my son's school, there are quite a few fathers who do the school run.
Yeah.
And they're running their own businesses from home, but the lady of the family, the wife or the mother, has a senior job or an executive job. Mm. And that, in our little world, is normal, but I'm not sure it is everywhere. And until it is everywhere, then perhaps women can't go all the way up the career ladder.
So we're speaking about gender here, but... There's a wider issue of diversity as well in the marketplace. You know, what are your thoughts on diversity in you know, not just our market sector, but generally?
I think there's a lot to do. You know, whilst things are improving for women, you know, there's a big focus on girls in STEM and women in leadership roles and the gender pay gap. But in terms of diversity in a wider sense, you know, we're three white, middle-aged, heterosexual people in a room talking about diversity.
Mike doesn't think he's middle-aged, though.
Okay, sorry. Sorry to break that to you.
He still thinks he's a youth.
I'm definitely middle-aged now. I did a pedalo with the kids on Saturday. My legs killed Sunday. So I know I'm old now. I'm gone.
But yeah, there is a lot to do in terms of, you know, embracing everyone. Mm. As I go back to my point, we're all professional individuals and that shouldn't come down to gender or colour or anything.
No, I agree. I think us as like husbands, partners actually have a role in that. Because I think sometimes, because you've seen it, like I say, I always look at my dad, you know, he went out, he was the breadwinner and so on. Actually, when I first had my family, it was almost like my example of being a father, of being the breadwinner was to look at my father. So it's like,
It's the blueprint, isn't it?
It's the blueprint,
you've got this blueprint of that what you should be.
Actually, sometimes you almost put the pressure on yourself as a man to do it, and there's probably the wrong outlook on it, really.
But everyone gets through. Everyone makes their own life decisions based on their own circumstances, and you know, it works for us that my partner runs his own business from home, so he can do the school run, and that was the sort of decisions we collectively made when I was going back to work.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about social media.
Okay.
You wrote an article, which people don't do on LinkedIn. People don't write articles.
Okay.
Because they're long form. Why did you write that article? But also, were you quite surprised by the reaction that you got from it?
Yes. I wrote the article for a couple of reasons. One was just because I wanted to take time to reflect and celebrate the fact that it was 12 months, but also as part of, to be cynical, but it was part of our company marketing. As I say in the article, one of our key issues is that it's such a great company and a great brand, but it's not very well known in the UK, so we need to shout about it. So it was part of that overall strategy. But yeah, I was genuinely overwhelmed by the support and replies that I got.
So what's the plans going forward with the marketing strategy for the business? Have you got an idea of how that's going to take off and take over the whole of the UK?
I don't want to give away all our secrets. It boils down to, key principles, doesn't it? We need to stay close to our customers. We need to understand what they value. And we need to present that value back to similar companies that would also benefit from it. I mean, that, it's as basic as that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we will use social media as part of our overall marketing strategy. But We've got a lot to learn about it. I've got a lot to learn about it. It changes every day.
I think we all have, haven't we, chat? Yeah.
Well, I've learned.
Yeah.
I'll just say it. The crapper the post, the more intent, the more engagement I get.
Okay.
So I will put a post on about doing a webinar, about helping people with CV clinic, about helping them with interview tips and all this, and I'll get 3 likes, 500 views. I'll put a picture of a really bad cut tube with a massive bear on the end against a wall, and I'll get 300 likes and 500 comments or something stupid. I'm like, okay, that's so. It's a social media that where people try to get of engagement and content. It's actually, I suppose, the thing behind it is it has to be able to quickly comment, a quick comment, I think. I think as soon as it's, someone said to me the other week on a webinar, they said, if you go on Facebook, you go on there to check out what your friends are doing, people who are just outside of your bubble, I suppose, you're a bit nosy. Some people stalk on it. Let's be honest. I'm not guilty of it.
Speak for yourself.
I don't stalk on it, but people do. But that's what you'd use Facebook for. Twitter would be used for like following people that you're interested in, maybe. Chefs, musicians, and so on. Instagram's very much the same, and it's just
showing off,
yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, when you go on LinkedIn, you don't necessarily go on there with a meaning behind it. You actually just do what I do sometimes and just scroll through. Something catches your eye. You might read it. And that's what I think people miss, is actually to get people engaged. There was something with that article that you've done there where people actually engage, because why have they... You know, when you just scroll through, don't you? You know, and that's where I think people win then on LinkedIn, because it's got to stand out.
It's the consistency as well. You know, having a message and just repeating it over and over again in different ways to kind of generate that engagement. I think it's really, really tough. And I think one of the issues that, you know, we're seeing, you know, without trying to pitch what we're doing at Compton Media, is we're looking at it and thinking, I know from when I was running my business, and you know, running HydroScan now, you've got 15 hats on every day, haven't you?
Yep.
So you're aware that you need to have a social media presence. It's the way forward in itself, what people are going to be doing. But to create content that people want to look at, particularly if you're putting video content out there, it just takes so much time, and it really detracts from just doing what you need to do.
It's always going to be the last thing you do of the day, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing. No one wakes up, and well, unless you're me, but like, I wake up and think I need to do my post. But most people don't. You know, when I was working in big distribution companies, sticking a LinkedIn post out wasn't really on my mind. It was more just seeing what's out there and sometimes using it to say, I've got an inquiry for this. And it was more, you know, to get suppliers to kind of someone to recommend you to someone.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't really be a thing I'd think, well, I need to put a post out today.
It does need to be planned. It does need to be really thought through and stuck to. But it's got to be interesting. For me, that's the difficult part is, you know, and the really pleasantly surprising part about the article is that actually people did want to read it. So, so we need to work on that.
Yeah, it's a good article.
Present things that people are actually interested to see.
What were you taught, Mike? Because you had like this eerie thing, didn't you, where it was got to be engaging and interesting and exciting and relevant. Yeah. And there was all these terms, and you almost have to hit X amount of these pillars to get. And we have tried it, and it definitely works when you hit the brief.
Entertaining, relatable.
Yeah.
And interesting, I think
there was a couple of others,
but I can't remember. I never brought my notes.
Sorry, Mark.
I picked up my flask instead.
In the article, you talked about, you know, what's been going on.
Mm.
Because really, as everyone knows, it's been a bit of a disaster, hasn't it, for most businesses over the last 5 or 6 months, because we've had... Like, this is unprecedented, really, isn't it? We've never had this kind of experience. Not where the whole globe is locked down.
No.
You know, and potentially, I mean, they're saying now in the UK, what is it, 6 people? So it might be shutting all the pubs down again. Like, it just seems bonkers, doesn't it, that we're going backwards again. But can you talk to us about, right at the start, how did you feel? How did you cope? How did you deal with your team and your staff and... Because I'm guessing it was tough.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm very lucky that I'm really well supported by the wider Hydroscand group. And I had regular conversations with our CEO because we were late in the process of the corona spread.
Yeah.
So a lot of the other Hydroscand businesses had already got, you know, they were already there. They were already locked down. They were already dealing with it. So I was sort of prepared, although I still couldn't believe it until I saw it for real.
No.
I was sort of prepared with some of the operational things we would have to put in place. But that evening, the 23rd of March, you know, I received text messages from different parts of the team saying, so we're going to work. So we're not going to work? Do I go to work? So I immediately on that evening was sending out messages saying, go to work. We'll have a conference call in the morning and we'll sort it out. And we carried on through because we support key workers. You know, we're not key workers per se, but you know, without our services, some of the machinery, some of the vehicles couldn't keep moving.
Yeah.
And it's the same for all of the fluid power industry, really. You know, across the board, that we carried on supporting those customers. But at the very beginning, getting that message clear was part of the challenge. You know, we worked together with the Trade Association, who've done a brilliant job, actually, you know, representing the industry and sharing information back from government. So we worked with them to put our case back to the government that actually in this industry we are key workers and we should be open. So we carried on throughout and I talked regularly with the team. We'd sent them home. We'd asked the very, very small head office team to go and work from home 2 weeks prior because it was coming. So we'd given them laptops and asked them to go and work at home. And then, you know, kept in regular contact. We did put people on furlough, but that, again, was a very rapid learning curve of, okay, what's furlough?
Yeah.
Who's eligible? How does it work? What's the HR process for that? You know, and we're a small team here in the UK, so a lot of that was for me to write all the letters and have all the conversations from afar. But we managed, and the team did a brilliant job. And some people wanted to be on furlough, some people didn't want to be on furlough, some people were on their own in a depot, and we do have lone working policies, of course. You know, but the technicians were all working remotely, so we did what we had to do. But the working it out at speed and trying to make sure that everyone was informed and comfortable. It was challenging. It was very tiring, actually. Plus the personal stress of, you know, is my family going to be all right? And is everybody else's family going to be all right? And what does this really mean on a personal level as well as from a business level? So, yeah, it was an intense few weeks.
It was kind of the unknown, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like you said, you've obviously got, because Hydroscan, you've got, what, 20-odd countries with Hydroscans?
20 countries, yeah.
So obviously we were further down the food chain with regard to Corona happening. But even though you're talking to people who've maybe got 1 week's more experience than you, they still don't know anything.
A lot had happened, though. I mean, as we found, it happened really fast, you know. And I remember being told that the team in Latvia had moved their trade counters outside so they could serve customers in the open air.
Right.
And I was thinking, okay, well, they must have had a good reason to do that. And then within a number, like 2-3 weeks' time, thinking, I understand why they did that.
Yeah.
It was all strange.
Did you try that? Is that what you were having to do, or how did you?
No, we didn't. We didn't physically move the counters outside, but we are serving some customers outside. You know, if people, even now, when people come to the branches, because face coverings are mandatory by law. You know, if someone's forgotten their mask, we'll just go outside. We'll just say, you know, what's the problem? Let's have a look at it, and we can take the parts in and bring parts out to them. We're just adapting, doing what we need to do.
But you're right, really. At that time, so early on, I mean, you were learning.
Every day,
wasn't it? Like 5 o'clock, I mean, like, or was it 5:30, whatever it was. That's when decisions were just made out of your control, how it's going to affect your livelihood, your business, and what's going on, and the others within your team. It was crazy, really, wasn't it?
Mm. What would you say to people looking to take that step to become an MD? So obviously you've dropped into an MD position, and then there's been a lot of things that weren't in the book. You know, the training book, you know, the idiot's guide to running a business. It's not in there, this kind of stuff. So, you know, what would you say to those budding entrepreneurs out there? You know, any top tips for how to handle a pandemic? Big question.
Well, maybe we should write that book. I don't know. We did our best. Yeah. And fortunately, I can say everyone is all right for the moment. You know, and we have a busy operating business. So that's clearly a good thing. But I think we were ready. You know, if you've been leading big teams of people for a long time, the principles, you know, did I know what furlough leave was or how to put it into operation? No, I didn't. But did I know that people needed to take comfort in the fact that, you know, we were still operational, they were going to get paid, you know, what health and safety measures we were putting in, that I suppose looking after people is part of the job, isn't it? And from a duty of care, but also from a, you know, just being a team point of view, that I think those principles stood leaders well. An experience from the past, albeit not specifically the same, I think we probably did know what to do. We just had to think a lot harder about it.
It's definitely going to be an interview question, isn't it, for senior managers, or people who are going into senior management or going for another senior management role. Like, it's going to be the interview question, isn't it? How did you deal managing your team during COVID-19? It'll just be...
One day at a time as well was part of it. Like you say, we were learning every day, and the parameters changed. I mean, they've changed again just now, haven't they? So we just have to keep up with the rules and keep up with making sure everybody knows what we should be doing. And just the key message was stay close with customers and look after customers to the best of our ability.
Yeah, that's right.
And by keeping in constant touch with everybody, we knew, you know, when we needed to bring people back in, and because we had almost half the team on furlough at one stage, albeit not for very long. I'm very pleased to say everybody's back. But
the thing was, is I found when I was block washing, is we were speaking together, and the way I listened to it is you interpret it different to how someone else did. And then it was waiting for the information to actually officially come out. And
you almost feel sorry for the government, though, because you can imagine for them, they've got to come out with guidelines. And they're just not sure, are they? They keep having to change. They're backtracking all the time. You know, it's not... I wouldn't want to do the job. I wouldn't want to be the minion that Boris sends out to do the report every day.
No, it was a tall order for them to get information to all UK businesses at speed about how you use the furlough scheme, how you need to be safe to be open, you know, who is and isn't a key worker anyway, you know, all those messages. Yeah, it was confusing, and they had to act really quickly.
Because they're trying to help everyone, aren't they? I mean, this furlough scheme really has saved a lot of businesses.
I think, cynically,
when we look at the fallout historically 2 or 3 years down the line, I'm sure there's a lot of businesses that have used this as a good opportunity to kind of shift a bit of dead wood, unfortunately, but that's clearly happened in the market. But there's been other businesses we've spoken to where they've got rid of no one, and you know, you look at it like longer term, it's fantastic. But you know, there must be other market sectors. We were laughing the other day, weren't we, about some of the like the loan companies, you know, the ones that are doing the higher rate loans. And of course, Boris at the moment is just, you can have whatever money you want for nothing at the moment, can't you? So they're really, really struggling. So I just think that whatever they would have done, there's going to be winners and losers.
I just hope that, you know, all the sort of leisure and entertainment activities can get back soon as well.
Yeah.
You know, say we're in a good position in the industry that we're in that our services are needed for key operations, but yeah, I wouldn't want to be running a theatre right now.
No, definitely not. We've been asking all our guests, and I know you probably won't want to answer this question, but can you talk to us about the biggest error or mistake? Ideally, the costliest one. Those are the ones that people like to hear. When you've really thought, well, you've thought, I wasn't thinking.
I don't know the financial cost attached to it, but I think the biggest error was when I worked at SIG. So I was commercial services manager, and one of the many parts of the function was to manage supplier rebates. So we were privy to some very commercially sensitive information. And, you know, this was...
I know what you're going to do here. I've got a feeling, but I'm not going to jump in.
So this is, you know, and this was really a very serious matter from the highest level of the business, that we knew what this information was. And one day, in error, I had accidentally left a part of an attachment. So I deleted a lot of things, but I'd accidentally left the full terms from one supplier attached to an email, which I sent to all the branch managers. So...
Yeah, how did that go down? In fact, I'll tell you what, rather than how did it go, how did you feel? How many times did you die inside?
Oh, yeah, just the once, but, you know, immediately and in an epic way. As soon as I knew what I'd done, I went directly to the managing director because he needed to hear that from me and not somebody else. And he was quite reasonable about it, to his credit, because I knew it was stupid.
I've done it before. I've sent the purchase order to the mill, but rather than send it to the mill, I've sent it to my customer.
I think many people
exactly
have done that.
What you've made on the job.
But isn't it stupid though, with emails, that you can't retract it?
I know.
Well, ever since I did this stupid thing,
the same with a text message.
It must be 10 years ago now that this happened. But ever since, I have my Outlook set up so that messages don't leave my outbox. So when I hit send, the message goes to my outbox and stays there. And then later, when I'm comfortable that I haven't attached anything that's confidential, then I do send and receive and they go.
So you've living for 10 years now.
And forevermore.
Yeah. With that little niggle in the back of your head that you're going to drop another...
That gives you the opportunity to just check, you know, maybe you want to change your mind.
Yeah, that's it.
We've all done it.
Sending the emails that they have. I've done what you've done. Sent back reply to all and says, nice order there, just made an absolute killer. Copied the bloke in. Like, you know, reply back saying, oh, do you want to have a review of the price? Like, yeah. Yeah. It's all right, mate, I'm leaving next week.
Look, thanks for joining us today. It's been great to have you down, and good luck. Let's hope the next 12 months is more fruitful than the first one.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much.
I'm so happy.
Yeah, wow.
We've just played around on Google, like you probably did when you heard about Mike saying Danny Dyer wasn't in the bill.
Yeah, he was in the bill, weren't he?
Yeah. Was he in Casualty?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he was in Casualty. He wasn't in Doctors, though. I thought I was going to get the hat trick. Honestly, yeah. I was so excited.
I can't get over it. I mean, I was a real big...
And he's 43.
He's 43, I thought he was about 36. He looks good for his age, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Considering, you know, you're 36 and you look 43.
38.
Yeah, 38.
Oh dear.
But yeah, I lost on that. I was obviously wrong again.
That's good. It's good to know.
Yeah, again, it just proves, you know, a lot of these
a lot of these people who've gone very high up and become real key decision makers in business, they've all got that, you know, the further education, putting themselves out there, doing a lot of stuff away from work. You know, there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there?
If you look though, because the three we've had that we've done in this kind of bottom to top series at the moment, Rob didn't go to uni, Sue didn't go to university, and nor did Rebecca. All of them have done a lot of work while they've been at work, haven't they? Further education in the workplace. And that's what's kind of really set them apart and given them that ability to go straight through the tree.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I never looked at that.
I hadn't until just now. I literally just thought it. I
had an epiphany.
I did, yeah, epiphany moment. But we've got a lot of podcasts to come. This is the sixth one. We've got Steel Scout coming down next week. So that should be interesting. We're going to be talking about their e-commerce platforms and how that's developed over the last 2-3 years. We've got a podcast on the future laser.
Yeah.
We recorded one bit of that where I think your mind got exploded, didn't it?
God, yeah. That was intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God.
We got a couple more of those to cut in. So that should be quite interesting. Then we've got Danny Phantom on soon as well from FC Laser. He's going to be talking about how that business has... I said earlier in the first take, I said it's like John Lewis. And obviously people know that John Lewis model. Everyone who works there has got shares in the business. Apparently they've gone bang on that.
Yeah, so I'm just Googling it now because I'm probably wrong on that as well.
Did they? What?
John Lewis in Birmingham definitely closed.
Yeah. But anyway, if we ignore that...
No, John Lewis, yeah, they're still there.
Wrong. There you go.
I mean...
It was just one of the stores they've closed. But yeah, FC Laser have changed their model now. So we're going to be talking to Danny about that, as well as how FC Laser have grown so quickly in that market sector. And then we've got a couple of other podcasts that we want to do. One's going to be about e-commerce in the metal sector. So, you know, from Steel Scout, we're going to be talking to other companies that have got e-commerce platforms. So if you'd be interested in featuring on that one, get in contact with us. And then we're also going to talk about social media and marketing. We think that that's obviously quite key in the metal sector. So we've got podcasts coming up on that as well. But for anyone that's been listening that hasn't subscribed, you can subscribe on whatever your preferred podcast channel is. It really helps us if you write as a review as well. So at the moment, the best way to do is that through Apple Podcasts. That's where the reviews tend to work best. But yeah, write as a review if you can. That really, really helps us, and it helps with attraction. And the main thing is to share it. You know, if you've managed to get all the way to the end, this is like an hour in now to this podcast, you've listened all the way. If you've enjoyed it or you found any of this interesting, then the likelihood is that people like yourself who are working in the industry would as well. And the only way for us to kind of grow this and create something meaningful in the metal and engineering sector is to start spreading it around and people start engaging with us. And if anyone wants to give Mike some stick about his lack of knowledge of TV, drama.
Yeah. And business with John Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. 2 out of 2, mate.
But they do have 20% off menswear at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was just having a look at some nice chinos. So
nice. Yeah. Corporate chinos.
Corporate chinos, yeah. Oh, beige.
Cheers for listening.
Take care.
We'll catch you soon.